from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is running for a third term, and because his Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton is running for Senate, he had to pick a new Lieutenant Governor. That man ended up being Christian Mitchell, a former deputy governor and former state lawmaker. Mitchell joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about his journey through Illinois politics and whether he's prepared to be governor if Pritzker departs office early for the national political scene. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me in the studio, he covers all things Metro East for St. Louis Public Radio.
Will Bauer.
And our very special guest today, he is the Democratic nominee for Lieutenant Governor in the beautiful and great state of Illinois. Our guest today is
Christian Mitchell. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. Before we pepper you with policy and political questions, who is Christian Mitchell? And how did you get involved in the wacky world of Illinois politics?
Well, again, thanks so much for having me, guys. Who is Christian Mitchell? Christian Mitchell is the son of Debbie Gist, who lives here in Illinois, and the grandson of James Gist, my late grandfather. They were really the two people who raised me, and they are my heroes. And my mom was a NICU nurse, neonatal intensive care, so taking care of literally the sickest and most vulnerable babies for 38 years of her career. And then my grandfather was a union steel worker, but also was a sergeant in the U.S. Army and very proudly served in the Korean conflict. And so who I am is their son and grandson. You know, I grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago, Maywood and Westchester. Had a pretty normal suburban life until I think, like so many families in Illinois, we found out we were just one hit away from having some economic distress. That happened for me when I was in high school. Both my grandparents got very sick, one with dementia that became Alzheimer's, the other with heart disease, that being my grandfather. And my mother got breast cancer. Fortunately, she beat it. She's a survivor for more than 20 years, but it turned our lives upside down. And I think that really put me on the path to public service. I initially wanted to be a lawyer and make money and make sure my family didn't suffer. But in meeting people, both after college when I was a community organizer and then during my time even in college, I found out my story was not uncommon. And in finding that, I figured that one way to make a difference was by trying to change the system to make sure that what happened to my family and so many others would be less common, to try to lower the cost of healthcare, to try to raise wages. And that's why I ran for a state rep for the first time. It's why I joined J.B. Pritzker's administration as deputy governor for the first time. And it's why I jumped back in to run for lieutenant governor.
Maybe a silly question here. How is a deputy governor different than a lieutenant governor?
Not silly at all. So thanks for the question, Will, and I'll try to keep my answer short. So there are four deputy governors in Illinois. They're high-level staff positions, a little bit like a deputy chief of staff. There's one for education. There is one for budget and economy. There is one for health and human services. And the job I had was infrastructure, energy, and public safety. So I oversaw a suite of agencies, some of our biggest and most complicated ones, like Department of Transportation, Illinois Commerce Commission, Environmental Protection, the National Guard Bureau, which rolled up to me, which is how I first got involved with the Illinois National Guard, the Illinois State Police, and the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. And then I had a suite of policy things that I covered So I was fortunate to lead the Rebuild Illinois Capital Construction Program, $45 billion for roads and bridges and vertical infrastructure like our universities. And then CEJA, the Climate Equitable Jobs Act, to put us on a path to 100% renewable energy. So that was my job as a deputy governor, which is a staff level position, serves the pleasure of the governor. Lieutenant governor is the elected role, number two in the constitutional role, a line of succession, I should say, and is elected by the people. And that's the job I'm running for right now.
And for the last couple of years, you've been out of the world of elected politics, and you were kind of just mentioning why you're getting back into it. But tell us more about why you want to jump back in to state politics after having been away for a couple of years.
Yeah, I ran for office because I thought I could make a difference because I had seen really good elected officials make a difference for their community. I was fortunate to work for Tony Preckwinkle, who had been an alderman and is now county board president in Cook County, huge on criminal justice reform, fiscal responsibility. I got to work on a couple of campaigns, including President Obama's reelection in 2012. So I saw what good elected officials could do, and that's why I wanted to be involved in the first place. And when I looked up, you know, I was at the University of Chicago, which is my alma mater. I was a vice president. But it's a nonprofit. And I was watching the things that I cared about in Illinois, all the progress we made during JB's term on, yes, infrastructure, but also getting our education system, billions of dollars in new investments, our credit rating being upgraded rather than downgraded as it was over 10 years before JB was in office. I saw all that under attack by Donald Trump. And potentially by Darren Bailey, who was not yet the nominee, but I thought stood a good chance of being it. And you don't sit on the sidelines when something like that is happening, when the Voting Rights Act is under attack, when there are 9 rural hospitals in the state of Illinois that could close because of the Medicaid cuts that Trump has proposed in HR1 and on which Darren Bailey was silent. When you get a chance to step up and be involved in trying to make the state that has given you everything that you didn't get from your God and your family, as Illinois has been for me, you take that shot. And when we can help move Illinois forward, work on the Illinois 2050 plan and make sure that we're creating jobs and making this a great place to live. And when you get to work with somebody like J.B. Pritzker, who you love and respect, that's just the kind of opportunity you don't say no to.
Before I ask my next question, did the governor hold it against you that you went to the University of Chicago and not Northwestern University?
You know, I got to tell you,
governor.
Totally, Jason. I got to tell you, I think his bigger issue is that he roots for the wrong baseball team. He's a Cubs guy. I live 15 minutes from Comiskey Park. I know it's got some different names now, but for those of us who are from Chicago, it's Comiskey. So I think that's probably his bigger issue. And there's probably a little bitterness around rooting for the wrong baseball team.
Not to get into a tangent, I grew up in Buffalo Grove, but I am a lifelong White Sox fan because the Cubs were terrible in the 1990s, and there was no reason to root for them. And we had the more dominant championship team, as I'm sure.
You know, first of all, Jason, clearly you're a good man, and I appreciate that. I will just also say, so my family are all Cubs fans. So really quick aside from me as well. So my mother's side of the family is from Sparta, Tennessee. So I spent a bunch of time in Sparta. My father's side from Meridian, Mississippi. What a lot of folks don't know is the way the WGN network is cut, it goes all the way down to Tennessee. So you got a bunch of Cubs fans in Tennessee. I became a White Sox fan when I came south to go to University of Chicago in 2004, win the championship in 2005. I look like a genius. And, you know, we're in a rebuilding phase for the last 21 years. It's fine.
Yeah. And my wife, who is from the southwest side of Chicago, is for some reason a Cubs fan. But we can hold that against her. But let's get off of this tangent. There is a lot of speculation that Governor Pritzker is going to run for president after he gets reelected. And I'm sure you're not going to announce that he's going to do that on this show. But it does put increased focus on the lieutenant governor, since you could be elevated if Pritzker either becomes president, vice president, or takes a cabinet position in a Democratic administration. So I want you to talk a little bit about why, if the time comes, for whatever reason, you are ready to become governor of one of the largest and most important states in the nation.
Yeah. JB has always said, he said this for Juliana Stratton, our wonderful lieutenant governor, who's now, God willing, going to be our next United States senator. The number one qualification for the job of lieutenant governor is being able to step in if anything were to happen for whatever reason. And for me, I was talking about this a bit in response to Will's question. I was fortunate to oversee some of our largest agencies, our transportation system, emergency management, and our state police, as well as our National Guard. I oversaw a very broad policy portfolio that covered everything from infrastructure to energy, public safety, election reform. So I have, I think, a fairly broad amount of experience from that time on the executive level. I was a legislator, and so much of what a good governor, lieutenant governor do is work with the legislature. So I think I have really significant experience there. But most importantly, all that prepares me to be the best governing partner I possibly can be to J.B. Pritzker. If anything happens, yes, I'll be ready. But for the most part, what I'm really focused on is how I can be the best lieutenant governor I can be, help move the state forward, help our farmers, help our small businesses. That's the thing that I'm really, really excites me to get up in the morning.
So as we look at your opponents for November, I have kind of noticed that maybe in some ways Darren Bailey has either broken with President Trump or maybe even the national Republican brand in a few cases this cycle, right? And he's said that he's his own person. He's criticized Trump for posting the AI image that had depicted himself as Jesus. He criticized another AI image that the RNC posted that mocked Governor Pritzker's weight. He apologized for calling Chicago a hellhole, which he did 4 years ago, and he recently even made that appeal to the city council. But correct me if I'm wrong here, your team doesn't seem convinced that he's maybe changed. Why so?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's good that Darren Bailey knows that Donald Trump is not God. I think that's a good start. But I think that the proof of the pudding remains in the eating. And I always grew up, my mother always said, if you want to know who someone is, you should not listen to what they say so much as watch what they do. And I think that for Darren Bailey, there are a series of things that he has not changed his position on, right? He still said abortion is worse than the Holocaust. He is still someone who wants to roll out the red carpet in Illinois for Donald Trump. And, not, by the way, not just Democrats in Illinois are turning their back on Donald Trump. So are many Republicans and independents. One thing that Darren Bailey cannot seem to do is prove that he will stand up to Donald Trump in a substantive way. Here's one really good example. Darren Bailey is a farmer. He runs on being a farmer. He talks about that as an important credential, even though he inherited his farm and is a millionaire. He will not even stand up right now as Donald Trump is ravaging the agricultural economy of the state of Illinois. I was down in Jerseyville and Metro East a couple of months ago on a cattle farm. And they are being crushed by higher input costs, fertilizer, the cost of fuel, all these things from the war that Donald Trump started in Iran, but also from the tariffs that raised all their input costs while giving $20 billion away to Argentine farmers. And so you would think if you really cared about the people of Illinois, you were willing to stand up to Donald Trump on the very issue that is the thing you brag about, you would think that'd be the place you'd stand up. And he can't even do that. So why I would think somebody who is attempting to change their rhetoric, put lipstick on a pig, but not substantially change any of their positions to help Illinois women, to help Illinois farmers, would suddenly be a different person. Again, it's a difference between your rhetoric and your actions, and his actions say he's the same person he's always been.
Moving on to issues, I have lived through an Illinois governor who has served more than 2 terms, Jim Thompson, but I was not really conscious about politics during then. When he left office, I was, 7 years old. So I want to say I was paying attention to Illinois politics when I was 7, but I'd be a liar. So my question for you, given that the governor, whether you like him or not, has accomplished a lot in 8 years, what are some of the main priorities that a third Pritzker term would want to accomplish?
A couple of them are things I think that he's pushing right now, Jason. So, one is we've got across the nation, this is not just an Illinois problem. We have an incredible shortage of housing. Illinois needs to build something like 225,000 housing units in the next 4 or 5 years just to keep up with demand. The governor's right now pushing a build plan that would create more middle market housing, that would cut red tape, that would allow for a wider range of housing types, including things like ADUs, backyard cottages, or above garage sort of properties. Those sorts of things could all bring down housing costs. So thinking about how we make Illinois a more affordable place to live is a big deal. How we continue to lower costs generally and also raise wages. How we continue to, yes, fight Donald Trump in Washington to make sure tariffs go away and the lower costs, but also to make sure that healthcare is more affordable. Part of what you see, I think I mentioned this earlier from HR1, there are 9 hospitals, rural hospitals in the state of Illinois that will be in danger of closing from the Medicaid cuts in HR1. And oh, by the way, a whole bunch of safety net hospitals in cities, places like the South and West Sides of Chicago, Rockford, Decatur, that could be in danger from Medicaid cuts. So I think it's continuing to to make sure we protect the progress that's already been made. But also the other big thing, and it's going to be a focus of mine, is economic development all across the state of Illinois. It's why I was in Jerseyville. It's why I've been to Belleville, to Alton, to Cahokia. I've got vacancies on State Street in Chicago. I've also got main streets all around the state of Illinois that need to make sure they're places that people can live, work, and raise a family. So I think it's that economic development work and that broad vision of the future for Illinois and protecting the progress that's been made to keep us from going back in the way that Donald Trump and Darren Bailey would want to take us.
I'm not exactly an expert on the Illinois aspect of this, but what you were talking about with the HB1 is the fact that the so-called Big Beautiful Bill limits the percentage for a medical provider tax. It's a big issue in Missouri. I'm curious, is that a big issue in Illinois? How much would that cost Illinois, basically?
I don't know the exact number, Jason, but it's huge. You know, I was, as I think we mentioned, I went to the University of Chicago, but I also worked at the University of Chicago, which actually the hospital is the largest provider of Medicaid services in the Midwest. And that assessment program is huge for that, for the university, but also for a bunch of safety nets around the state. So it is millions and millions of dollars. And in fact, there was some hope that it would get scrubbed because of how much it was going to hit folks like Missouri. Senator Hawley was one of the vocal advocates against it and said they tried to paper over it with some relatively small fund that's going to effectively be, you know, a small cork in a massive, you know, hole blown in the dam that is Medicaid. So it's truly devastating. And by the way, Darren Bailey has said nothing about that, even though it is going to close hospitals in areas of the state that he would claim to care about.
In terms of other legislation, I wanted to ask about the Safety Act. So if elected, do you think the Pritzker and Mitchell administration will advocate for any changes to the Safety Act, particularly the portion of the bill that eliminated cash bail?
Yeah. So the thing to remember about the Safety Act, I want to just take us back for a second. I want to remind your listeners what people are defending. People were defending a system that prior to the ending of cash bail meant that your ability, your wealth was what determined whether or not you stayed in jail pending trial versus your potential threat to the community. We have multiple studies, Loyola did one, et cetera, that shows that the ending of cash bail has actually made us safer and has actually meant we can detain more dangerous offenders. We don't want to go back to a world where how much money you have in your pocket determines whether you get out of jail. Having said that, one of the issues I know people have raised a lot of issues about is electronic monitoring, making sure that the resources necessary to monitor folks are there. That may be an example of a place where some changes could be made. I think there are smart and credible folks both sides of the aisle who are looking at things that could tighten the rules a bit. But what we're not going to do is go back to a system where wealth determines whether you stay in prison and not how dangerous you might be to the community. So we want to give judges and prosecutors the tools that they need to make the case for detention and not be in a situation where how much money you have determines whether you get out or not.
We also couldn't let you go without asking you about data centers, because they seem to be like one of the hottest topics that seem to have really bipartisan pushback against, regardless if you're a Republican or you're a Democrat. And I know the Illinois legislature that you're probably monitoring has been, you know, thinking about a particular set of bills that would like limit or regulate rather data center construction, right? The Power Act, this legislation, you know, is requiring or would require that public, would require developers, right, do the public water use reports, environmental assessments, build renewable energy to power them. This legislation, from my understanding, has maybe stalled a little bit. But what would you kind of like to see done in this space to regulate, to limit, or whatever you would do with data centers?
Yeah. So you might have seen that the governor proposed, there was, as part of the Rebuild Illinois Capital Program, there's a data center tax credit that the governor proposed pausing. And in part, it's because there's really real concern from folks right now. And on the one hand, data centers can mean economic development. They can mean investment in what's necessary to keep, you know, growing our economy. On the other hand, they can mean massive power spikes for consumers. And I think that when you've got companies with trillion-dollar market caps, they ought to be able to guarantee my energy bill, your energy bill, you know, Jason and Will, and those of your listeners should not go up to do this thing that the trillion-dollar companies want. That is a doable thing, and we believe that we can do it that way. So we want to make sure that, like, yeah, we want to be part of a future that is building the economy and the jobs of tomorrow, but we want you to pay for the energy you use. We want you to make real investments in the workforce. We want you to make sure that people living near these data centers are not the ones left holding the bag.
You mentioned the, I don't want to say demise of the Voting Rights Act, because the entire Voting Rights Act did not get struck down by that Supreme Court decision, but certainly the demise of the protection of majority-minority districts, which has prompted a bunch of states in the South to start dismantling heavily African-American and heavily Democratic districts. Louisiana, Tennessee, South Carolina actually decided not to do that today, which was kind of surprising. And there's obviously litigation with Alabama. There's probably going to be a lot of pressure for states like Illinois to redraw its map in 2027. I guess there's a couple of questions I have here. Can you actually squeeze any more Democratic seats out of the current map? And if you can, would that require making existing African-American majority or Hispanic majority seats more white? And would that really be worth it just to gain maybe one or two seats in Illinois?
I mean, let's start with the foundation of what this is. And what this is voter suppression. What this is the dilution of African-American voting power directly, full stop, absolutely, in some of the states you've mentioned. But I also want to remind folks that much of the representation that diverse folks of all backgrounds, whether they're Asian or Latino or African-American, have comes from the Voting Rights Act. And this has been a systemic effort over 15 years. Section 5, now Section 2, undermining the ability of the Justice Department to oversee potential discriminatory things like voter ID or other things that try to take away minority voting power. And then after making it harder for people to register to vote, putting even more emphasis on partisanship in a way that undermines African-American and minority voting power. That's what this is. I will say to your question, here in Illinois, we have always drawn our districts in accordance with the Voting Rights Act in ways that are consistent with the Illinois Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. There probably isn't a lot of room here to do much more, just to be really direct about it. And so I think that what the governor and myself and others are going to focus on is how do we support efforts in other states to combat this sort of voter suppression. But we have really focused on acting in accordance with the Voting Rights Act, both locally and nationally. And so I think our maps are in pretty good shape.
My last question before I let you go, and this is kind of on the same topic, but from a different angle, was actually listening to a Senate hearing where our junior senator, Eric Schmidt, accused the Illinois map of being racially gerrymandered and frankly racist, because there were a number of majority African-American and majority Latino seats. You probably have heard this argument pretty recently from Republicans that even the concept of majority minority districts are inherently racist. From a little editorial commentary before I asked the question, in Missouri, Republicans supported the majority minority first district because it helped Republicans. It was an example of packing, essentially. So Schmidt didn't vote against that when he was in the legislature. But you've heard this rhetoric. I'd be interested to hear what your response to it is. And do you think that the state of Illinois could defend a potential like Justice Department lawsuit arguing that your map is somehow running afoul of the recent Supreme Court decision?
I'm going to answer the last part of the question first, which is yes, I think that we could absolutely defend that. I think I noted in my earlier answer to your first question, Jason, that we've always drawn our maps in legal, technical, and electoral compliance with the Voting Rights Act. So I think we'll hold up fine. I always try to evaluate folks' comments in terms of sincerity. There was this moment, this is a little bit off topic, but I think it's illustrative. I was on the floor talking about House Bill 40, which was a bill to allow for the use of I think, Medicaid funding for abortion where appropriate. And there was a legislator who got up and said, this is going to have an overwhelming impact on African-Americans and their birth rates. And I said, effectively to this representative, this is the first time you have ever mentioned civil rights, voting rights, or African-Americans on the floor, and you are doing so in advance of your own ideological agenda. You are doing so to, quote, own the libs rather than from any place of real sincerity. I don't know much about Senator Schmidt. I'm going to go out on a limb and say he hasn't probably exactly been a civil rights crusader. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I would guess African-Americans in Missouri are probably not particularly thrilled with his leadership or sincerity. And so, I kind of view it as you're attempting to use a talking point in a way that you think is cute or exposes some level of hypocrisy, but there's no sincerity beneath it. And I think that in those situations, I just kind of roll my eyes. And say, if it's your first time trying to stand up for my community, your standing may not be as sincere as your posturing. That's what I would say.
Well, Christian, thank you so much for joining us today. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can find all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And Christian, how could people find out more about the Pritzker-Mitchell Democratic gubernatorial ticket?
You can always go to jbpritzker.com to learn about us. And then if you'd like to follow me on socials, it's just cmetchell for LG on X and on Instagram, and I believe also on Blue Sky.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.
Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, providing exterior solutions for homes with faded, cracked, or outdated siding. Details at callmosby.com.